No, you are listening to Arena, and this is Halloween night. Welcome along to When the Veil Between the Worlds Thins. Tonight we embrace the gothic and the supernatural across the artistic realms. Joining me in this shadowy studio is writer John Connolly, who has brought some spine-chilling tales that linger like whispers from the grave. Jess Fahey will unveil her gallery of dark art that unsettles the soul. Louise Bruton delves into murderous music that howls through the night. And John McGuire digs the sinister depths of cinema to reveal unspeakable horrors. And we will have no more of that for the rest of the programme. Good evening and welcome to Arena this Halloween evening. John, I'm going to start with you. Let's do that. Tell me what makes horror such an essential genre for film.
Well, horror movies, Rick, the good ones at least, they blast through cinematic boundaries and they challenge our standards of taste and narrative in a way that few other genres can do. Of all of the genres, horror is the most manipulative. It sets out to persuade us. And if it's done right, it is the most transgressive. It'll bring you to a place that you couldn't have imagined. And it's as old as cinema itself. They've been making horror movies since they started cranking cameras. And they've always been, horror cinema is always a reflection of social anxieties about a changing world. And it's little wonder, I suppose, that as a genre, it has never been more popular. Once the exclusive preserve of a night like this at Halloween, we get horror movies all year round now in a 21st century that is riddled with anxieties. And it's a new golden age of screen terror. Now, I would make no apologies for personal selection. Horror is a broad church in cinema. And my choices would lead more towards that intersection of the supernatural and the sociological and away from the kind of gory, sadistic slasher movies. There are classics in that genre. John Carpenter's Halloween just popped into my head, for instance. But its visceral, instant shocks of slasher cinema don't have that lasting effect of the stuff that comes from the occult and the weird and the uncanny.
So just on the off chance that people thought it was going to be Old Texas Chainsaw Massacre, instead you're focused on the occult and less on the slasher this evening. So yeah. Your first choice is Stanley Kubrick's The Shining.
Well, you kind of have to start with The Shining. I think it's the list, it would be on the everybody's list of the scariest movies ever made. And this is Kubrick's adaptation of Stephen King's novel, The Shining. It's famously despised by King. It was a bit of a flop when it was released in 1980, a very lukewarm critical reaction and mediocre box office. Kubrick had outraged King's fans with changes to the plot and left them bemused by the strange rhythms and syncopations of his kind of filmmaking. But like most of Kubrick's cinema, it has gained in stature over the years. A lot of those gloriously over-the-top set pieces, even individual lines of dialogue, have entered the popular consciousness in ways that very few horror films have. So we have, I will very briefly run through the plot for anybody lucky enough never to have seen it, who might be inspired to watch it by our conversation. This is Jack Nicholson in hyper mode, hyper madman mode. He doesn't just chew the scenery, he feasts on the scenery. His character, Jack Torrance, is a blocked writer who takes a winter job looking after a hotel in the middle of nowhere, the Overlook, this edifice on the side of a mountain in Colorado. Most of the film was actually shot in a studio outside London. And his gentle, timid wife, Wendy, who's played by the late Shelley Duvall, and his psychic son, Danny, played by Danny Lloyd, who never made another film, and Danny's imaginary friend, Tony, who lives in his finger, they come with him, but it's the isolation and the routine and the haunted hotel itself tip Jack over into madness and murder. And it's that descent into madness, which any of us could, it could happen to any of us. And it's brilliantly played by the entire cast. And that is, to me, ultimately more frightening than anything else that Kubrick can imagine. Lifts full of blood, the corpse in room 237, Lloyd, the phantom barman, trying to tempt Jack back onto the drink. And all of these things combine in a kind of a spiraling insanity that was mirrored by Kubrick's own approach to the material. Whether by accident or design, he drove everybody involved right to the edge, right to the precipice, insisting on take after take after take of even the simplest scenes. He did 148 takes of the scene where poor old Scatman Crothers, who plays the chef, Dick Halloran, is sitting in the kitchen explaining to little Danny what The Shining actually is. 148 times. That scene where Jack Nicholson goes through the door, here's Johnny, one of the most famous and most parodied scenes. That took 60 doors, 60 doors, and 3 days to film. I mean, and you have to wonder now, as the Cubicana is an entire genre of study. There's academic studies on how he worked, why he worked, and why he did what he did. And you have to say, he was trying to haunt them. He was trying to push them right to the edge of madness, because that's what he wanted to
capture.
There
is definitely an element of all work and no play, making something, something, something. I'll figure out how that finishes later.
Boy.
All my work
like
and
that.
More play, funny, something, something, something,
kind of,
yeah.
They did an exhibition of Kubrick's work in London a few years back,
yes,
and they
yeah.
did part of it was on The Shining. And just as attention to detail, because Jack Nicholson at one point retypes those words over and over again in the piece of paper. For the French one, they're typed in French.
Yeah.
For the Spanish edition, they're typed in Spanish. Yeah. That was the level of attention to detail.
It seems obvious to us now, John, that The Shining is a masterpiece. It's precise and meticulous. It's visually astonishing. It's deeply strange. And for me, anyway, very, very scary. The ultimate horror movie.
And we are going to take something from it now. This is Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance in a conversation with the barman, Lloyd, played by Joe Turkel.
A little slow tonight, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Mr. Torrance. What'll it be?
Now, I'm awfully glad you asked me that, Lloyd, because I just happen to have 220s and 210s right here in my wallet. I was afraid they were going to be there till next April. So here's what. You slip me a bottle of bourbon, a little glass, and some ice. You can do that, can't you, Lloyd? You're not too busy, are you?
No, sir. I'm not busy at all.
Good man. You set him up and I'll knock him back, Lloyd. One by one. White man's burden, Lloyd, my man. White man's burden.
Jess Fahey, the world of art provides much content in the supernatural arena. Did you have a problem choosing just a few for us to talk about tonight?
I did indeed, actually. I had a selection originally of about 30 that I thought were of interest. And
that's
just
the director's cut.
Yeah, exactly. I just couldn't choose. And it's one of those things that when you start to look for a theme like this in the history of art, of course, because we're looking at hundreds and hundreds of years, there's so many options. Often with works like that, you kind of have to, I suppose, find the ones that might still be in some way relevant today or relate today in some way to the way we view the world, or still scare us might be a good way of thinking about it.
OK, so just to remind people, if you want to look at the Arena Instagram at RTE_Arena, we will have some of the images we're talking about here. We're going to start with the wonderful Francis Bacon and one of the many studies he did of Pope Innocent X. This is a study after Velázquez. It's a very different image than the one that's in the original Velázquez painting.
Yes, so the original one is all about sort of a typical portrait of showing power and sort of importance of the figure. The version that we get from Bacon, which he actually took from a photograph rather than going to see the original, which he very adamantly declared he never wanted to go and see the original. So instead, as those who've been to his studio in the Hugh Lane will know, he liked to work from secondhand sources and to have them sort of crumpled up and thrown around. In the case of the Velázquez, it was very purple in colour instead of red. And he said that that was the reason he chose it. Now, when you look at this painting, you can't at all imagine that the reason he chose it was because he wanted to paint purple. It is one of the most terrifying images you're ever going to see, because instead of this proud, maybe a little stern individual of the Pope, we have this monstrous figure with a sort of melted face and wide open screaming mouth, which is a terrifying thing to behold. It has this sort of sense of the environment that he's in, almost perhaps like a cage, or maybe because it looks sort of melting, as if whatever is coming down into the room is taking the flesh off his bones, hence the scream. But it is, of course, unlike cinema, a silent scream, which I think adds to the terror, to the feeling of it just being so unsettling and so strange. So when he was asked, as I said he just wanted to paint purple, but everybody else has had their interpretation of it. Because it's such a well-known example of a portrait of a Pope, The immediate assumption would be that it is in some way a critique of the church. And given, you know, Bacon's background, growing up as a gay man in Ireland, it's very possible that, you know, that interpretation could be found there. Or in fact, his relationship with his father, who had just passed away before he started painting these, which was a known sort of violent relationship, and the Pope being kind of the Papa, you know, standing in for that role in the church, sort of father figure. So there's a lot to be read into it, but I think one of the things that is undeniable is just how terrifying it is to look at.
And if you've never seen it before, that is on our Instagram now. John Connolly, thank you for joining us. Your first choice, Sheridan Le Fanu, his novella Carmilla, which is one I'm not familiar with. Tell us about that.
Le Fanu, I guess, is the first great Irish horror writer, or supernatural writer of the 19th century. First, we should say there's a difference between horror and the supernatural. Horror, I think, is always to do with suffering, psychological, emotional, physical. And it's also something we experience horror on behalf of other people. For example, if you're in Ukraine at the moment, you're not horrified, you're terrified. We will look at the images and be horrified. There is a kind of distance involved with it. The supernatural is obviously involved with the unknown and things, the strangeness. Carmilla is overshadowed a little bit by Dracula. But until Dracula is published, it's the first great vampire story written by an Irishman, and it's quite transgressive. It's a lesbian vampire story, which is not something that we think about, particularly at the start of the 19th century, given that Queen Victoria was reputed not to believe that they existed. Lesbians, not vampires. She didn't have an opinion on those.
Or if she did, we don't know what
it was. We don't know what it was. And it's part of a collection called In a Glass Darkly. And what's interesting about Le Fanu is that short stories function better than novels for the supernatural. And I think that's why if you do a list of the 100 great books, supernatural books, a lot of them are collections of short stories or are novellas. And I think because a novel, because of its length, requires a conclusion and an explanation. A short story doesn't need that. It is, to use that lovely William Trevor phrase, the art of the glimpse. And what matters is that we get it. We're briefly shown something. It's not explained. The moment you have to explain the entity or the creature, the reason behind it, the whole construct begins to fall apart. And so I think it is interesting that aside from Uncle Silas, which is a piece of Gothic literature, Le Fanu favours the short form. And so there are five stories in In a Glass Darkly. Carmilla is probably the most famous. The most, for the connoisseur, I suppose, Green Tea is the other one. And Green Tea is about a man who's haunted by a demonic monkey. And later we've discovered that actually the British Medical Institute suggests that if you consume huge amounts of green tea, we're talking about 8 to 10 cups a day, you'll experience delirium and hallucinations. And Le Fanu, who lived by himself for much of his life after his wife died, fueled himself with massive amounts of tea. So it's quite possible that in the writing of this story, he was effectively fueling his imagination in much the same way that the narrator of the story is haunted by one of these images.
And what happens in the story?
Well, in Carmilla, it's basically a man being driven mad by something that may or may not exist. And I think that's where Green Tea tips into horror. What I was saying earlier, the idea of something that involves suffering, the breakdown of the human being, the breakdown physically or emotionally. Whereas Carmilla is much more of a supernatural story. It is saying these things exist and these things are real.
Louise, how difficult was it to find the supernatural in music? Did you have to search deep?
I think a lot of people fall into a similar trap when they're trying to come up with a Halloween playlist. And that is, they will go for the Monster Mash or they will incorrectly go for Zombie by the Cranberries, which is scary for different reasons. But there are far more albums and bodies of work out there that convey horror, convey the supernatural in ways that aren't so obvious. Usually it's murderous men and then it's witchy women. Witchy women who have been hurt by love, who are grieving, who have, you know, been denied fundamental rights, and then men who just want to kill for the sheer lark of it. So they're the two categories of music that I found myself in abundance of. And one of the more on-the-nose albums and artists to look at is Susie and the Banshees and her album Juju. the 1980s, great time for dark wave gothic music. In Susie Sue and the Banshees, they would have had Sid Vicious as a drummer for a spell. They would have had Robert Smith from The Cure also popping in and supporting a lot of their career. So there was a lot about that time that borrowed heavily from the gothic appearance, and that came out twofold, tenfold in their music. Spellbound is a love song at its core, but the way that Susie Sue sings this song, it's as appealing as snapping bones. She is so struck by love that it is corrupting her insides and her out. And the music itself just feels like a panic attack, the way that those stormy guitars by John McYoke are violent. And the imagery of it is something like from The Exorcist. That's what love is. That's what a woman in love is all about. Whereas, you know, there's also Spellbound, sorry, is a song that's also got its second lease of life because Lady Gaga has been sampling it on her single Abracadabra, which she released, I think, this year. So, you know, Susie Sue's permanence in this genre, it continues. And then another song very, very on the nose for tonight is Halloween. There's nothing more terrifying than the sound of children singing. and Susie Sue takes that chant trick or treat to a whole new level, and she makes it sound like something menacing. She's chasing after someone, a person that she wants, and she's teasing them with this trick or treat. You'll either take me or you won't. And, you know, good luck to whoever denies Susie Sue.
I'm hoping that many of our younger listeners won't find offence at that. They're probably out doing other things at the moment as we speak. Let's play something from that. We're going to take the one that people might recognise through the Lady Gaga sample. This is Susie and the Banshees from Juju, and it's called Spellbound. Welcome back to our Arena Halloween special, where we continue to explore our timeless fascination with the supernatural in the arts, where every note, frame and page pulses with otherworldly enchantment. Louise Bruton, Jess Fahey, John Connolly and John Maguire are still with me. John, what's your second choice in terms of films?
Oh, well, Louise just mentioned The Exorcist, so I'm going to talk about The Exorcist, William Friedkin's masterful adaptation of Peter Blatty's blockbuster Penny Dreadful novel, which is, as a film, as horrifying now as it was when it was released in 1973. At the time, it was one of the very few examples of a prestige horror movie. And there was some surprise when Friedkin, who had just won an Oscar for The French Connection, chose it as his next project. Up to that point, horror was really a cheap and tawdry genre aimed at, you know, lazy teenagers and grindhouse flea pits. But Friedkin's involvement made this a major motion picture, and he cast heavyweights like Jason Miller, Ellen Burstyn, Max von Sydow, and he used the latest special effects, the latest prosthetics technologies, which were very complicated, very expensive, and still, when you watch the film today, are hugely impressive. Von Sydow plays a priest, Father Merrin, who is called in by a desperate mother, played by Burstyn, to perform an exorcism on her 12-year-old daughter, Regan, who's played by Linda Blair, extraordinarily well played by Linda Blair. In contemporary Washington, D.C., Merrin and his assistant, who's played by Miller, Jason Miller, must cast out a devil named Pazuzu, a demon that the priest had encountered before. And it's a film about the everyday appearance of evil and the duty of good people to confront it and banish it. And Friedkin's, no more than Kubrick, Friedkin's approach was total fear. He would fire a gun in the middle of a scene to unsettle the cast. He physically slapped some of his cast members. He brought in an enormous refrigeration unit, which cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and froze the set so that their breath could appear. When the demon appeared, the room would get cold and you would see the breath from his cast. This, you know, almost froze half the cast to death. And whatever he did, it worked. Put aside the horror of the subject matter and our natural fear of evil and the devil and all of that kind of psychological element that we bring to the supernatural, and put aside all the gore and the splash and the green soup and all the physical anguish that that Regan experiences, there is a bleakness here. There is an atmosphere in every frame of the film. When I was a teenager, it was a rite of passage to watch this on a tattered old VHS. And afterwards, you were changed. It is a transformative film. And, you know, it was a massive box office hit. It was a sensation. It is sensation. How could it not have that effect on audiences? Until Jaws transplanted it, it was the biggest box office success of all time. And its reputation has only, I suppose, increased since then. But among all the horrors and the furore, and the film's achievements are actually slightly harder to spot. You are overwhelmed by it, and it takes a while for it to settle with you. How Friedkin blends the religious and the mythical with the psychological and the everyday. How he draws parallels between the maternal love and the priest's unwavering faith. And the scale of his ambition to make a scary movie that would transform an entire genre of film and put the snobs in their place. And watching it again not so long ago, what really struck me was how good Linda Blair is at being a little girl. She's really good at being a demon. She's really good at being possessed. But that wouldn't be as effective. It wouldn't work as well if she hadn't convinced us that of her innocence as a child beforehand. It's not about necessarily where we arrive after the transformation. It's where we have come from that Friedkin is trying to hang on to. It's really, really smart and really clever and really scary. It is still very scary.
And it's quite a serious, it's an examination of faith.
Absolutely.
Well. It's quite a serious film for those people who are dismissive of the supernatural
test,
horror.
The Meron and Miller in particular, the way their faith is tested, the things the demon says to them through Regan's body, the challenges that are put to them, the truths and lies that they have to try to sort out while all this chaos is going around them, from an acting point of view, their performances are really quite extraordinary. And that sense of chaos and that anything could happen at any time is really unsettling.
Okay, we're going to take a moment from it. This is Father Karras, played by Jason Miller. He is trying to talk some sense into Chris Ellen Burstyn, but a mother knows her daughter.
I thought you were supposed to be an expert.
There are no experts. You probably know as much about possession as most priests. Look, your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She says she's the devil himself. Now, if you've seen as many psychotics as I have, you'd realize that's the same thing as saying you're Napoleon Bonaparte. You ask me what I think is best for your daughter. 6 months under observation in the best hospital you can find.
You show me Regan's double. Same face, same voice, everything. And I'd know it wasn't Regan. I'd know in my gut. I'm telling you that that thing upstairs isn't my daughter. Now I want you to tell me that you know for a fact that there's nothing wrong with my daughter except in her mind. You tell me you know for a fact that an exorcism wouldn't do any good. You tell me that!
Still getting shivers up the spine even just from that. Jess, what are you going to choose for a second piece of art for us?
Well, just from thinking about that and the sort of idea of the devil comes up a lot in the history of art, particularly if we're looking at, obviously, Christian paintings. The interesting thing in terms of how that depiction tends to work is that it will usually be some form of mixture between hyper sort of animal and human. In the case of Dürer, there's an incredible engraving, which is a part of a series of three that he made, each one representing a different part of life. And in the case of the one that relates to religious ideals and religious, I suppose, morals and the way to live, we have an extraordinary scene, and as I say, an engraving so beautifully, beautifully detailed of the knight. A knight, death, and the devil, so the knight with a K. So he is a knight in armour riding a horse through this very creepy kind of sort of valley, which, you know, again, has been related to Sam's and the idea of walking through this, you know, valley of the dead and what might happen to you. But as he's going by on his horse, he's determined to not look around. And right behind him is the devil. In this case, the devil is depicted as a goat slash pig type humanoid, but wearing quite an impressive gown or cloak, which is a little surprising, I think, for the devil, and staring right at him. And then just next to him is a figure representing death, typical in the sort of skeletal form, holding an hourglass. And ultimately, with works like this, that Durer knew would have, you know, great potential for being reproduced, because these are the types of subjects that we're looking at. You know, the 15 teens, we're looking at the Renaissance period. These are the subjects that people loved. So just as like we have a blockbuster like The Exorcist, this is the blockbuster of its day, but in printed form, because people liked to imagine this being real and what it would really look like. And if you think of an era where this is the only type of, you know, visual information you're getting, it's before film, before photography or anything along those lines. And this is so much the artist's imagination creating something that will stay in the minds of the viewers. But it is meant to have a moral. It's meant to have a message. So on this same path, you know, through this valley, the horse is just an inch away of putting its hoof on top of a skull. And in the history of art, skulls tend to represent not just a dead figure, but represent the bigger idea around this concept of we all must die, which we usually see as a memento mori, so a reminder of death, but also a vanitas. And that's a secondary important message to learn, particularly within the Christian context, because it's not just that you're going to die, but that there will be, if you believe, a world afterwards. And in order to get there, you shouldn't have vanities in this world. So you shouldn't have ambitions. You shouldn't care what you look like. You should only act for God. So this is a symbol that we find time and time again in works like this, and a way of, again, getting home that message. But I think it works particularly well because it's so creepy and so spooky, and people have always been drawn to things like that. They weren't going to get the message as clearly from seeing an image of heaven. It seems that the image of hell has always worked much better in getting people to do what's right than the image of heaven.
John, where are we going next with your supernatural stories?
We're going to talk about women, I think. When we dismiss genre fiction, and I think that was something that in Ireland we did and continue to do up to the present day, you dismiss writing by women. Because I think women, firstly, there weren't that many ways for a middle-class woman to make a living. If you were in the home, if you had trapped in a kind of domestic situation, writing was one of those ways. But also from very early on, women become very adept at using genre literature, whether consciously or unconsciously, to explore matters of concern to them and themes that interest them. And we've seen a resurgence in Ireland in recent years of horror writing and supernatural writing. I think a generation of academics, of publishers came together, came around at the same time and wanted to explore this literature that mattered to them. So we have Swan River Press. There's great work being done by Tramp Press, by a generation of academics in UCD and in UCT, UCC and in Trinity. And I kind of wanted to focus on Where I End by Sophie White, which I think is a very interesting book. When I read it in proof, I remember sending the publishers a supportive quote. And they said this quote was fine, except they didn't want to mention horror, because they felt it would put off readers. And yet it is a horror novel. I think it's probably the first great Irish horror novel of the 21st century. And women, I think, writing about horror have a comfort with the body, or a willingness to engage with the body, that perhaps male writers don't. And this is a book that could only have been written by a woman. It touches on motherhood and on the way the body can rebel against us, and elements of horror. And I think it's interesting also that she was, I think, the first Irish writer to win the Shirley Jackson Award, because I think Jackson is a writer that we can discuss in unison with her. Jackson's most famous work is probably The Haunting of Hill House, and a short story called The Lottery. And Jackson had a famously troubled marriage. Her husband was compulsively unfaithful. She was trying to write while trapped in these small town American houses with four children. And perhaps it's not surprising when you pick up her work to see that the two most famous works touch on that. I mean, The Haunting of Hill House is about people trapped in a house. And what's interesting about Hill House is that there isn't a ghost in the traditional sense. It's the house itself that's insane, and we're told that in the first set, there's something wrong with the house, and the people who are trapped in it are then become, all of their problems are kind of poured out in this poisonous atmosphere. And The Lottery is about suburban life. You know, it's about a small town where sacrifices have to be made to maintain the comfort and security of it. And all the time you can feel her questioning this environment that she's in, questioning what it's like to be a woman, a creative, intelligent, immensely gifted woman being stuck in this dreadful domestic situation. And either consciously or unconsciously, it feeds into everything that she's doing.
Louise, what's your next port of call?
I may continue on this tangent of witchy women and murderous men. And there's two albums that I have here that have a gorgeous link between them. Bath Time by Maya Sophia, the Galway singer-songwriter. Her 2019 album, it focuses on the stories of ostracised women who've long been misrepresented in history. And one such song is The Wife of Michael Cleary, which illustrates the ghastly final hours of Bridget Cleary, his wife, who was burnt to death because he believed that she was a changeling. So this song is visceral. You can almost feel the fire crackling on your skin, the ashes going up your nose. It's a haunting, haunting song. And you can hear the influences of Susie Sue and Nick Cave on Maya Sophia's writing style. But also on the album is a more subtle Elizabeth, which is about Elizabeth Siddal, the English artist and poet who had modelled for the pre-Raphaelite brotherhood. And she was actually a stand-in for the painting Ophelia, which is an image that was also used by Nick Cave and Kylie Minogue for the video for Where the Wild Roses Grow. So that unlikely...
Nice tie-in. I like where this is going.
Thank you. So this unlikely duo, this unlikely pairing, two Aussie queens were joined together for this unlikely hit that brought Kylie over more to the side of the indie gang and brought Nick Cave over to a mainstream spotlight that he rejected. He actually asked to be removed from a lot of nominations from MTV Awards in 1996 when his album that this single was from, Murder Ballads, was released. So Murder Ballads, a grand total of 65 men, women, children and animals are killed on Murder Ballads. And that is not a number I came up with. I was courtesy of Apple Music because I could not count the bodies for the blood on Murder Ballads. Nick Cave is known for his ghastly music. His storytelling is violent. It's horrific. It is, you know, it comes like a punch. It also comes like a dagger in the back. And he explores this on Murder Ballads. The name is just so literal. And this all began when he had a song called O'Malley's Bar that he just couldn't find a place for on any of his previous albums. So he was like, do you know what? Let's make a whole album about murders. And he just goes hell for leather with this. And Where the Wild Roses Grow is probably the more melodic of songs on the album. So when people were drawn to that song because of its chart success and beautiful Kylie doing vocals, they would have been very surprised to hear that the rest of the album wasn't so beautiful.
Okay, let's take a little bit of that. It is the song that possibly changed all of our impressions of Kylie forever. It is from Murder Ballads, Nick Cave and Kylie Minogue, Where the Wild Roses Grow. Welcome back to our spooky special arena to celebrate Halloween with ghostly contributors Louise Bruton, Jess Fahey, John McGuire and John Connolly. John, another movie for us. Where are we going with that?
Well, we've had two classics. So how about a modern classic? There's a rich crossover between horror and science fiction. I'm thinking about Alien or The Thing or The Fly, all of which are extraordinary films. And these are films that ask the question, what if the boogeyman was never a man or a woman, never human? Not some projection of humanity even, or some echo of us, but something utterly strange, unknowable and inhuman. And the first film that pops into my head is Jonathan Glazer's extraordinary adaptation of Michael Faber's novel Under the Skin, which over the course of a strange and troubling observation certainly buries its way under your skin.
Let's have a listen to a short clip from Under the Skin.
No girlfriend, really.
Oh, I don't have a girlfriend at all.
You're very charming. It's better.
Yeah, sorted.
You have a handsome face.
Aye. Yeah. Thanks a lot, cheers.
You think I'm pretty?
Aye, you're gorgeous.
Do you?
Aye, definitely.
Good.
Scarlett Johansson plays an alien scout in contemporary Scotland, travelling the roads looking for men on their own that she then seduces into getting into her van. She takes them back to some place where she uses an inky bath of black goo to transform them into maybe energy, maybe information, maybe food. We don't know. It's very obtruse. It's very askew. None of this stuff is explained to us. And over the course of her work, her daily work, she becomes curious about humanity and makes an attempt to cross over, to kind of become like us or to understand us a little better. It's all scary. It's all terrifying. But there's a couple of standout scenes. One in which she seduces and then spares the life of a man with a facial disfigurement played by Adam Pearson, which is as heartbreaking and wrenching as it is disturbing. And another, and I can still recall the gasp this scene elicited for me the first time I saw it, which is set on a wild and windswept beach. And if you've seen the film, you know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to explain it here, because in this film, nothing is explained. Nothing is certain. We have to gather the data as we watch and engage in what we collect on a deeper level. It's a very challenging film, hypnotically beautiful, as all of Glazer's films are. But this is horror cinema, and Glazer's perfect visual aesthetic of horror is matched frame by frame by this scratchy score from Mika Levy, who's superb. Johansson has never been better. And it's interesting, Glazer hasn't made that many films, but he followed this with his Holocaust movie, which won him an Oscar. And you can sense the darkness building in Under the Skin that we then saw later. And it's interesting that as horror has become more mainstream and horror themes have pervaded cinema throughout cinema, that a filmmaker, an artistic filmmaker like Glazer, is drawn towards these darker themes because he knows that's what we want. This is what we want, is to be challenged by things that are frightening and transgressive.
Jess, how do you follow that?
Well, one of the things that just occurred to me as Dom was talking was that quite often when you do look at women's stories, it doesn't take anything that dramatic. It can just simply be stuck at home to be a horror of a life. And one of the artists that occurred to me as the other Dom was talking is the Irish artist Patricia Hurl. So her career really initially in the 80s seemed to be about to take off when she exhibited a work called The Living Room, Myths and Legends, which was in the Temple Bar Gallery and Studios. And ultimately, she brought objects from home. So there was her couch, her rug, her little side table coming directly from her house where she lived with her husband and I think four children. And in that very domestic, very safe space, she surrounds these objects with some of the most extraordinary, expressive and really quite moving and in some ways terrifying works. So there's a combination of things that relate directly to her own personal life and some that relate to stories in the news. So she painted, you know, subjects like the Kerry baby subject and story and things like that. But in terms of the work I've chosen for today, it's a work called Irish Gothic. And what we have in this painting, and it takes its format and the title from American Gothic, which is a painting by Grant Wood from the 1930s, which is either viewed as being a sort of idealistic view of the simple life in the Midwest, or it's a critique of that exact thing, and that this is, you know, a kind of backward way of being. So she's very aware of that and then transports that into this Irish context with the title. So in her version, instead of these perfectly, you know, very sharply, crisply painted individuals like in Grant Wood's, her figures look like their faces have been sort of melted again or scratched off the surface. There's this blurring of their faces. Behind them is a very sinister looking house with a very dark night sky. And then in front is a picket fence. But this picket fence is a very dark brown and looks more like this sort of mouth of a monster that's about to destroy these individuals. So the thing that's really interesting is that you have this expectation, or at least there was that expectation then, that a woman who's married with children and has a house should be perfectly happy, and that this is the sort of dream of this, you know, Irish society. And here she is responding to that and expressing all of this, you know, dissatisfaction and all of this feeling of being trapped. And again, kind of the horror in the situation, as she does eventually in her own life leave that marriage. And she's now part of a group called Nkailika, who are an extraordinary art group who are a mixture of visual artists, a jazz musician, a curator, a filmmaker. And they took their name Nkailika from sort of old version of a kind of witch-like figure in Irish mythology. But rather than see it as a negative, as the female, as this witch figure often is in literature and film and in art, they see it as a positive, as this point of strength, as this Celtic goddess who was feared because of her power. And in particular, if we look at the situation in Ireland where women didn't have that power, and that, you know, trapped in your house could have been the scariest thing, you know, for you. Now, of course, some people would have enjoyed it and had a great time, but it is really interesting to see an artist progress through their career and have that freedom now. It's really quite exciting.
Female writers and female artists suffer a similar fate. Mm. One of the things that marriage does is it takes away your name. Mm. And I think that was one of the reasons why quite often they began to fall out of the canon or fall out of, because actually their name had changed. Mm. And there was no interest in following through and maintaining that tradition. Mm. So that frustration that comes out in a writer like Shirley Jackson and the artist you were discussing, that commonality is really interesting.
Another thing that just occurs to me to talk about is the idea of space and a room of one's own. You know, so thinking of Virginia Woolf and that idea of space. Patricia Hurl lived in the suburbs and would have to get a bus into town to maybe do an hour or two of painting. Or if you look at someone like Lee Krasner, who painted on a small scale because she had the spare room, whereas Jackson Pollock had the barn. So his works are huge. So even just in terms of the amount of physical space their artworks are allowed to take up can matter from the space that they're given. But you're very right in saying that idea of kind of negating, because if you look at, you know, even 20th century artists, if they had a husband who was an artist, the husband was known and the woman was secondary. In some instances at exhibitions, there would be a small minor room, almost as if wife also painted. You know, really interesting that that's only slowly starting to change now.
So that's Patricia Hurl's Irish Gothic. You'll be able to see that and all of the other works of art that Jess has been talking about tonight. They're up on our Instagram at RTE_arena. John Connolly, what unsettling reading would you like to tack on to that?
Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, you know, there are probably people listening who think, well, I don't like any of this stuff. I don't like being frightened. I think I can't imagine why anybody would want to pick up one of these books or listen to this music or look at this art.
They're in the wrong place tonight.
Well, they are. But I think it's very interesting because there are clearly some people who don't like it. And obviously, the one reason is it's for some of us, it's entertaining. It's fascinating. We find it interesting. But I think sometimes I'm often interested in why it develops in childhood and adolescence. Why are those the points when we become perhaps interested in art that's transgressive, in stuff that's frightening? And I think it's because actually the world is frightening when you're an adolescent. The world is very difficult to know. Your body is going through this weird process of transformation. So why wouldn't you want to read about vampires and werewolves? They're your people. But also we never cease to be frightened. And the things that frighten us change as we get older, but fear doesn't. You know, I'm at that stage now where, you know, I've been older parents, so I worry about her. I've got kids and a grandchild, I worry about them. And I'm gradually becoming aware of my health, you know, that I may not beat the odds. I'm still hopeful, but it's possible that I won't. And so the writer, I was going to pick Emore James because I just love his short stories, but I actually think it's fairer to pick Stephen King because he is very good on this. He begins his career because he's a teacher. He's writing about children. He's writing about adolescents. He's up close with them all of the time. He's very good about domestic situations that are appalling, abusive parents, addictive parents, because he knows addiction himself. Gradually that begins to change as he gets older. And then he suffers this catastrophic accident in 1999 where he's hit while he's walking by the side of the road. And the novels after that become different. They become about that, what we were talking earlier in terms of horror, the body's capacity for suffering, the mind's capacity for suffering. And again, you see people in novels who are recovering from injury, who are struggling with because he became re-addicted to painkillers, to opiates, who are dealing with that. And the later novels now, I've found people with Alzheimer's, people who are enduring old age. So he's going back to every time. I think that's why he's lasted so long. He's conscious of the fact that fear never leaves us. It's always going to be with us. And so for parents who worry about that, who worry about the kids reading what they see as maybe dark material, I think it's very important to allow children and adolescents to negotiate fear.
to put names onto what are things that are actually formless. And so if I was going to give an adolescent a King book, I'd probably give them a book like The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, which is about a child lost in the woods and being followed by something that gradually assumes a form. John and I were talking earlier about Salem's Lot. Mm. Which was certainly the first King book that I ever read.
It was very good.
But again, at its heart, it has teenagers. All of his themes are there. Teenagers, people, young people dealing with parents who are not good father figures. Because King understands that actually the worst monsters are human. Mm. You know, the vampires, the werewolves, they're, by the by, the worst are the people you have to live with, the people that you trust and who let you down.
Let's take some music after that, although I doubt it's going to be any less unsettling. What have you got for us, Louise?
Well, the first album that came to mind when we were given this assignment was The Bride by Bat for Lashes. So this is an incredible album by Natasha Khan, also known as Bat for Lashes, released in 2016. It was a follow-on to her album The Haunted Man, so, you know, haunting people isn't too far away from Bat for Lashes' usual work. But the album The Bride deals with the fallout with a woman whose husband-to-be dies on the way to the church in a car crash. And how she realises that this is happening, it happens in sort of a Carrie-esque vision. She's standing at the altar in a song in God's house, and she sees the fire that's engulfing the car, and she realises that he's not late, he's actually dead. And the whole album just follows on her, you know, running away from the horror, from that, avoiding the grief. She begins to chase a figure, the figure of grief, which is called the Sunday Love. The track is called Sunday Love. The character is called Sunday Love. And it's a woman with these pale, ghostly eyes. And as she fears this figure, she also begins to pine for this figure. It's a very complex album about grief, death, horror, and generally just being a woman.
And that, sadly, is where we have to finish. My thanks to our ghoulish guests tonight, Louise Bruton, Jess Fahey, John McGuire and John Connolly. John's third collection of supernatural fiction, Night and Day, is out now in paperback and it's published by Hodder. Jamie Doyle was on sound tonight. Our BCO was Ollie Hamilton. Research was by Paula Shields. And tonight's show produced by Reg Luby. You will find some of the imagery that we've been talking about tonight on our Instagram account at RTE_arena. We're going to leave you with some Bat for Lashes, one of Louise's choices. Happy Halloween, everybody. Have a great weekend. We will see you on Monday. And this is the most horrific thing you will hear tonight. On Monday, it will be 52 days until Christmas. Good night.